Professor Miller is a British sociologist specializing in propaganda, lobbying, corporate power, Islamophobia, and the Zionist movement. He's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's also a senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zaim University. He previously held professorships at the University of Strathclyde and the University of Bath before joining the University of Bristol in 2018 as Professor of Political Sociology. In 2019, a campaign of harassment against him began at the university involving the Community Security Trust and Bristol Jewish Society due to his teaching about the Zionist movement's role in stoking Islamophobia. That campaign continued to snowball, later involving numerous British politicians and Israel lobby groups, and Professor Miller was subjected to 3 internal investigations at the university, which found that his remarks were neither unlawful nor anti-Semitic. Nevertheless, in October 2021, Bristol University dismissed him for gross misconduct. Professor Miller challenged his sacking, first with an internal appeal and later at an employment tribunal, and in February 2024, the tribunal ruled that Professor Miller's anti-Zionist beliefs, which view Zionism as inherently racist, imperialist, and colonial, qualify as a protected philosophical belief under UK equality law. However, under pressure from the Zionists, Bristol University appealed that landmark legal victory to the Employment Appeal Tribunal. But Professor Miller has won yet again, solidifying a binding legal precedent protecting anti-Zionist beliefs under equality law for years to come. And it's my honour to welcome him to the show today. Professor Miller, thank you very much for taking the time to join me today.
It's a pleasure.
And a huge congratulations to you on your stunning victory.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased. And I'm very pleased in particular for everyone who has supported me and everyone who stood with me. I couldn't have done it without all the support I've had, including the many thousands of people who have donated to our crowdfunder.
Well, I'm sure everyone who stood by you, myself included, feels vindicated and overjoyed at your success. So very well done to you. And of course, to your lawyers.
Yes, indeed. Of course, Zach Samur, Gianna Seglias, Zilla Rahman, and Jahad Rahman, Rahman Lowe have been a tremendous asset in this fight.
And my congratulations, of course, extends to them as well. Professor Miller, the Zionists and their proxies in Britain have waged a years-long war of professional persecution against you in a bid to break your will and to tarnish your credibility as Britain's preeminent sociologist in the post-war period. Walk us through exactly how that process started and why they targeted you.
Well, I mean, the targeting that you mentioned in your introduction about 2019, that's when the proximate start date is. But actually, of course, there was a long hinterland to that. So the first time that I got attacked by Zionists really was when we launched in the Commons, in the House of Commons, a report on neoconservative think tanks. And along to the event came several Zionist trolls who I'd not come across before, including Jonathan Hoffman, and then his sidekick, Richard Millett, was also there. And they started to filibuster and shout out things. And I remember Ansel Tikriti, who had funded the report, trying to shut them down and stop them. I said, no, no, let them speak, let them speak. I was like, what are they saying? This is curious. So I kind of was interested to hear what they had to say. And then, of course, I realized that these were just professional Zionist trolls. And that was the kind of my introduction to Zionist trolls. I couldn't really understand why they were there. What were they objecting to? We'd done this report on 2 neoconservative think tanks. And of course, it was the dawning of my realization that what we were doing here was irritating a very sore subject for them, because we were looking at these neoconservative think tanks, and what we discovered was that the main funding bodies for these neoconservative think tanks were family foundations who were also giving money to the settlements and to the IDF. And that was at the beginning of our realization that neoconservatism was a Zionist movement, was funded by the Zionists to promote Islamophobia. And that, of course, was that insight, the idea that Zionists promote Islamophobia was, of course, the main issue which the 2019 campaign against me started with. So it was that was a real insight into what it was that they wanted to do. And after that, from 2012 to 2019, there were several other incidents. One that I remember was the first time I was described as being an anti-Semite, which was that I had hosted an anti-Semite doing a book tour in Scotland who had come to stay at my house. It was true. I had hosted this person in my house, and he'd written a book called Overcoming Zionism. It was a guy called Joel Covell, famous New York Jewish anti-Zionist, comrade of mine. And that was the first time I was described as an anti-Semite, because I'd offered a Jewish anti-Zionist a bed in my house overnight as part of his book tour. So that was an indication for me of just how ludicrous all of this was. And it, of course, has become more and more ludicrous since then. So just to jump forward now to the point you started with, which is 2019, I did a lecture on the 18th of February 2019 when I'd been in post at Bristol for 4.5 months. And some weeks after that, a letter from the Community Security Trust was dispatched to the university, quoting two anonymous students from my class as denouncing the anti-Semitism that there had been in this lecture on Islamophobia. And I didn't see that letter. They didn't show it to me at the time. I only saw it some 6 months later after they investigated me and found out that actually I hadn't done anything such as anti-Semitism or anything like that. And that was the beginning of it. So the two students wanted to be anonymous, didn't want to make a formal complaint, even anonymously. So what happened then was that the Community Security Trust went to the Union of Jewish Students and the president of the Union of Jewish Students at the time and got her to sign a letter along with the president of the Bristol Jewish Society, which is part of the Union of Jewish Students, which, of course, is a Zionist organization. And they then wrote a letter to complain. And they were able to make a complaint because the one who was the head of the Bristol Jewish Society, was a student. The CST has no basis to make complaints about members of staff. You have to be a student to do so. So as a result, at that moment, the head of the Bristol Jewish Society took the complaint, and the name of the Union of Jewish Students leader president was taken off the complaint because she had no basis. So that was the beginning of the complaints.
But what exactly were they complaining about? What was the content of this lecture that was so terrible to them?
Well, this is a two-hour lecture, which I had given many times before, and indeed to many places around the country, many universities, on Islamophobia. On we wrote a book, edited a book on Islamophobia, and the thesis we advanced was the idea that there were five pillars to Islamophobia, and that the main pillar, the backbone of Islamophobia, was the security state, the counter-terrorism apparatus of the British state. But that there were four social movements which also helped to push the state further and further into anti-Muslim activities. And those social movements we described as being the neoconservative movement, the elements of the left, the far right, of course, the EDL and the Tommy Robinsons of the world, and of course also parts of, as we said, parts of the Zionist movement. And it was that section of the lecture which particularly outraged them. And we can tell what I said then, because this one of the students recorded part of it and leaked it later to the Jewish News. 2:44 there is of this tape of me discussing the relationship between Stanley Kams, the former treasurer of the Conservative Party, and Zionist lobby groups, his funding of neoconservative think tanks, his involvement in supporting the occupation. And the one of the things that the anonymous student said in the first complaint was that this is an ordinary Jewish businessman who's being attacked for just being Jewish. And of course, you know, the evidence which we had on that was given in the lecture, and indeed in the slides which I had put up in the lecture at the time. So this was a nonsense complaint, but nevertheless the university felt it had to investigate. When the formal complaint came in from the head of the Bristol Jewish Society, although she had was never a student of mine, she was an English student, and so the complaint was taken by the dean of the faculty and judged in the end in the summer of 2019 to be no cause to answer.
So this initial investigation cleared you?
Yes. And so then the response to that was to say the head of the Jewish Society said that she complained that the university hadn't adopted the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which is, of course, the Zionist regime's definition of anti-Semitism. And the university then voluntarily said to her, well, if you want, you can put another complaint in after we decide whether we're going to introduce the IHRA. So she said, oh, yes, I would like to do that once you've decided.
The idea being that when they introduce the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, they might be able to catch you out.
Yeah, yeah. And so they then introduced the IHRA and backdated the crime. And of course, if you remember, the crimes that I had committed in these complaints were not just crimes in that particular lecture, but they were statements that I had made going back years and years and years, you know, way before the IHRA was even created in 2016. So that's when that happened, that whole process happened. And she put in revived the complaint, effectively appealed. And at that stage, and this is during COVID, of course, at that stage, the university decided to give the investigation to an external QC, as it was then.
Senior lawyer.
And between, I believe, March 2020 and December 2020, she investigated and she wrote a huge report, I think nearly 100 pages. And she found that none of my alleged crimes went anywhere near being either illegal or anti-Semitic, even taking the IHRA definition into account. So even when with the IHRA, they didn't really get anywhere. So I was given a clean bill of health at the middle of December 2020. And then we had the position that the university was reluctant to tell anyone that they had found that I wasn't anti-Semitic. So I was still getting, you know, the press reporting about me and pressure from the press. And the university refused to tell people, refused to respond to requests from the media by saying, actually, Professor Miller has been determined not to be anti-Semitic. They simply refused.
So after an initial investigation where they've cleared you, and after probably spending, let's be honest, tens of thousands of pounds hiring a Queen's Counsel, as it then was, to investigate you, and then both investigations clearing you, they're refusing to tell anybody that actually this is what the outcome of this independent report is.
Sure. And so then we go to the next phase of the catalogue of disasters. So I went on around about the 20th of February that year, so 6 weeks, 2 months later, I went on a public meeting, a defending free speech meeting. And I mentioned, I remember the words very well, as some of you will know, I have been attacked and complained about by the head of the Bristol Jewish Society and the president of the Union of Jewish Students, both of which are Zionist organisations. And that was enough for all hell to break loose, and huge outpourings of grief and gnashing and wailing of teeth by Jewish student organisations and Zionist lobby groups. So one of the things which was interesting was that when I made my comments in February about saying I had been attacked and complained about by the head of the Bristol Jewish Society and the president of the Union of Jewish Students, I deliberately not mentioned their names to avoid personalising it. And that was the mechanism by which the Zionists were able to shoehorn in outrage about it, because what they then said was that I was defaming Edward Isaacs, who was the new president of the Bristol Jewish Society, and that he had nothing to do with the complaint. Now, of course, I knew he had nothing to do with the complaint. He knew that I knew that. But nevertheless, they said, well, he's clearly attacking me because I'm the president. Now, of course, I was referring to the previous president who was involved in the complaint, as everybody knew. And so they used that to summon full outrage, and that's what led to the comments really blowing up in the press and in social media. And then what then happened was that when it came to the investigation of me by the university, the second investigation, the students submitted evidence. They were given pro bono advice, free legal advice by Adam Rose from Mishkan de Rea, the law firm which operates for the Israeli embassy. Amongst the submissions that they made, Isaacs and his deputy said that as a result of my comments about him, which weren't about him, He had had anti-Semitic abuse. And they evidenced this with screenshots of responses that he had got from various people as a result of the comments, he said. Now, first of all, the screenshots were not as a result of the comments. Second of all, the screenshots were all from one person. They made it look, because they photocopied it in different sizes, that it was different people, but they were all from one person. And third, they weren't anti-Semitic. Right? And I can tell you the reason why that's the case, because what had happened was, quite separately from anything to do with me, Edward Isaacs and his deputy had tried to join an anti-Zionist Facebook group. And the person in charge of that Facebook group, none other than Tony Greenstein, had written back to them saying, "You're Zionists, you can't join an anti-Zionist group." And of course, being Tony Greenstein, he was a little bit rude to them. And they then presented this as if this was a show of mass anti-Semitism, which had been promoted or provoked by me. It was a complete nonsense from start to finish. Now, they knew that, and Adam Rose must have known that as well. So what they did essentially was they falsified evidence to try and suggest that there was a problem. Now, of course, in the end, the investigator at Bristol, when I was able to show that's what happened, they had to withdraw all of that from the investigation. But nevertheless, it had a role in starting the investigation in the first place. And this time they appointed the same QC again to do another investigation, and she found that I hadn't said anything wrong. But they also appointed someone internally, which they hadn't done previously, to look at the broader aspects of the problem, whatever they might be. And he determined that even although nothing I'd said was anti-Semitic, nevertheless, I had mentioned students, and this was a bad thing. You can't mention that you're being attacked by Zionist students, by students who belong to Zionist lobby groups. And therefore, he decided that I should be, that there was a case to answer for me to be dismissed again for questions of misconduct. And the report that he wrote was then sent on to another academic in the university, who is now the Vice-Chancellor of Nottingham University, Jane Norman. And she determined that that mentioning the students was gross misconduct, and I should be sacked. And the reason that I was being sacked was because that I had mentioned students. And that was the only reason I was being sacked.
And these, of course, are not just innocent Jewish students. These are dedicated Zionist activists on campus. We know that some of them, during and after university, have engaged in Israel advocacy, lobbying. One of the main complainants against you, Edward Isaacs, actually visited the Zionist entity while he was at university. He spoke at the Zionist Ministry of Foreign Affairs, cozied up with Boris Johnson, and later became president of the Zionist Union of Jewish Students. These are not people who are just Jewish students on campus. They're deeply involved in Zionist campaigning and politics.
Well, all of them have been deeply involved since their youth, at least, including two who were writing for the student newspaper, and the two who were the successive heads of the Bristol Jewish Society, Nina Friedman and Edward Isaacs. And they, of course, both got on to have very senior roles in the Israel lobby, one in the Jewish Leadership Council, for example, and one in the United Jewish Israel Appeal, I think. So they've been rewarded with effectively leadership roles in the British Zionist movement, which is quite something for kids just out of university, if I can put it like that. So yes, that all happened, and that was the process by which they had me sacked. I was cut off from the 1st of October 2021 without any redundancy pay. Didn't pay me a penny, and haven't paid me a penny since then. And that's the position we're still in.
We've spoken a bit about how the campaign against you unfolded at the university. But of course, the campaign against you was the Zionists' largest and most thorough campaign of persecution against any academic in British history. I think that's very clear. Talk us through the details of the tactics used against you and some of the individuals involved, because this became something much bigger in British politics. It wasn't just confined to the university campus.
So I think it's important to understand that when I mentioned that in 2021, I'd gone on a public meeting and mentioned that there'd been this campaign against me. That was the first time I'd spoken about it. I'd been told previously that by the university I wasn't allowed to speak to anyone about it, including my colleagues. I wasn't allowed to speak to my colleagues about what was happening. So most of my colleagues had no idea at all of anything that was happening. They saw stuff in the press about me, but they didn't get any information or briefing internally from the university, from the department, or from me, because I wasn't allowed to talk to them. So you find yourself in a kind of odd situation where you're not allowed to talk about the most important thing that's happening to you.
So just to be clear, the university had put you under a sort of gagging order.
Yeah, yeah, while the investigation continues. So that's part of the context of this. And of course, in the end, I felt I had to speak out and to talk about it. And of course, they didn't like that. One of the things the university said throughout this is that I should not talk about this. There was a point at which they offered me a settlement deal. They would give me some derisory sum of money, and they would come to some kind of settlement. But one of the key conditions of the settlement was a non-disclosure order, where I could never again talk about what had happened to me. And of course, there was never any way that I was going to be doing that, and there never will be a way I'll do that.
Mm. But just more broadly, you have this university gagging order. But there were other actors involved. There were British politicians from the House of Commons and the House of Lords in the UK Parliament, local politicians. There was a wide variety of different lobby groups. There was a group of academics who supported you, a group that were against you. So talk a bit about all of that.
We had a campaign to support me, and lots of people signed on to that at the time. It was great to get that support, but equally there was an academic campaign against me. Academics from all over the place, including outside the UK, and then also internally there was a couple of letters, or maybe three letters, from academics internal to the University of Bristol, which had something like 40 or 50 signatures. It's when you see that and you look at the people on the list and you realise the extent to which there's just, as a matter of course, a Zionist phalanx within the university. So a large number of Zionist staff who, in moments like this, come together to draw up the drawbridge and to try and have me removed from my post. Now, they technically said they didn't necessarily want me to be sacked, but that was the import of what they were saying. So there was that, and then of course there was also public complaints to the university, including from funding agencies. So Zionist funding agencies talked about how they were thinking about withdrawing their funds, etc., etc. And one particular celebrity refused to collaborate with the university while this Miller matter was ongoing, and that was a guy called Matt Lucas, who of course has subsequently come to be known quite publicly as a bit of a Zionist. So all of that happened. And then, of course, there's the external campaign of pressure. And it was led by the Zionists, by the campaign against anti-Semitism, by the Union of Jewish Students, by the Community Security Trust, the Board of Deputies got involved, and various other Jewish Leadership Council, I think, as well, other Zionist organizations. But there was also a specific element of it which came from Parliament. So there were questions asked in the House. Several parliamentary committees discussed the terrible things that I was alleged to have done. And then, of course, there was a famous letter which I think had more than 100 parliamentarians sign up to it, including, we should mention, of course, Caroline Lucas of the Green Party, who signed on to that letter demanding that I be sacked. And that was an important part of it. The university really took that very seriously. And in addition to that, there was also letters from Lord Mann and various other key anti-Semitism anti-Semitism actors in the political establishment. So that was all part of that as well. And then more widely, I guess, you mentioned local, so the local mayor, Marvin Rees, who was elected in Bristol as part of the Corbyn bounce, and became he got into being the mayor as a result of this sort of left wing vote in Bristol, and that, of course, turned his back on all of that straight away, and he was very, very supportive of the student campaigners against me, and was critical as well. So that all of that came together to pressure the university to take action against me, and then to take action against me again and again, until they eventually sacked me.
I think it's difficult to overstate the sheer forces that were being mounted against you. The pressure against you was unreal. I mean, I previously worked for Chris Williamson, who was a member of parliament. And the day that he was suspended from the Labour Party at the behest of the Zionists, there was so much pressure coming from all angles. It seemed like every Zionist asset was being mobilized to come out of the woodwork to attack him, release a statement against him, badmouth him in the press. But with you, honestly, I remember it feeling maybe twice or three times as heavy as that. They really pulled out all of the stops to get the university to sack you. Professor Miller, just turning to the recent appeal which Bristol University launched after you won your original case in 2024, what were the most interesting and vital parts from the appeal?
So the appeal took 2 days. And it was in London at the Employment Appeal Tribunal. And it was heard by the new president of the Appeal Tribunal, a guy called Lord Fairley, who's from Glasgow. And it was one of his first big cases since he'd become president. The appeal that Bristol put in had a large number of points of law on which it was appealing. One of the funny things about the judgment is that Lord Fairley puts in a line about how there were nine grounds, and each of them, most of them had sub-grounds, and some of them had sub-sub-grounds. And you can tell from being there that he's expressing a great deal of anger about the way in which Bristol presented this case. And that was the most hilarious thing about it. So let me just tell you the story. I mean, we were in this small courtroom, and we were, you know, the Bristol was on the right, we were on the left, facing the bench. And behind us, there were maybe 15 or 20 seats, mainly filled with my supporters. But also a number of Zionist journalists were there and a couple of other Zionist observers, including journalists from the Jewish News, the Jewish Chronicle, and Joshua Rosenberg was there, who, as you know, is the husband of Melanie Phillips, famously was the legal affairs correspondent for the BBC for a number of years. And so we're all sitting there, and the way in which the evidence is given is that the Bristol's counsel gets to stand up and have 4.5 hours of time, four hours first of all, and then half an hour at the end, and then we have the same. He gets up and he starts into this discussion about what a terrible person I am.
This is Bristol's lawyer.
Yeah, that I'm an anti-Semite, that I did all these terrible things, that I support Hamas and all this kind of stuff, right? And after about 15 or 20 minutes, the judge is kind of looking quizzically at him, saying, "Can you?" Direct me to the point of law in your submission that this relates to." And he said, "Oh, I'll get to that." And he went on and on. And the judge didn't understand what was happening at first. He kept querying Christopher Milson, who's counsel for Bristol, "Mr. Milson, which point of your evidence does this relate to?" And of course, he didn't really ever get to that. He spent almost the entire time just trying to denounce me and trying to, I don't know, convince the judge that I was a wrong-in, and therefore it must obviously be the case that the tribunal judgment should be set apart. And the judge got increasingly angry about that. And in the end, he said, can I use up some of my rebuttal time from tomorrow to finish my case? And they allowed him to do that. And in the end, he had something like 5 minutes left for his half an hour rebuttal the next day. It was just a hilarious piece of nonsense. My counsel, Zach Samour, got up and did his speech, and he finished with 1.5 minutes to spare, sat down quite properly, whereas he riled the judge up something awful. And by the time we got to the end, right at the last minute, he said, "Can I have some more time?" And the judge just, one word, "No." And you can really see that play out in the way in which the judgment's written, where he talks about the sub-points and the sub-sub-points. They didn't have a clue what they were doing legally, and it was a massive overreach and a strategy born out of desperation and pressure from the Zionist movement, I guess, possibly also the professional vanity of their council. But if you were in charge of legal at Bristol University, you must have been very, very embarrassed. And certainly the people who were above you in the hierarchy would have been very embarrassed by that. That's how that worked. One more detail, because most of the people in the public gallery, it wasn't really a public gallery, it's just seats behind us, were supporters of mine. They kind of could hear what the Zionists were saying to each other. And there was a moment just before Joshua Rosenberg left where he leaned over to, I think, Jane Prinsley from the Jewish Chronicle, the Jewish News, and said, just before he left, they should have got KC. So he was saying that, the Bristol case was clearly a disaster. And that's how it turned out. And we waited for this judgment for 8 months. Judgment should be within 3 months. Lord Fairley did say, I'm very busy, I might not get it out in 3 months, but I'll try my best. It's 8 months it's taken to get this judgment out. And of course, we sat there thinking, what could be taking the time? And you don't know if you're going to win or what's going to happen. And of course, when the judgment comes and you see that we've won on every single point, just amazing. All of their objections, all the legal objections, one after another, rejected, 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 rejected. It's really an impressive read, considered in that kind of way, that every single one of their objections simply ruled out of order as being manifestly not appropriate.
What do you think were the most important parts of the judgment itself in terms of protecting anti-Zionists?
Well, the first thing to know is that although the university had said that I'd been sacked because I'd mentioned students, the first court, the tribunal, had determined that that wasn't the real reason I was sacked. That the real reason I was sacked was because I had expressed anti-Zionist views, which the university thought were beyond the pale. And that therefore that I'd been wrongfully sacked, because they determined that my anti-Zionist views I set out in the 100-page submission I made were coherent and clear and sufficient to meet the bar to be a philosophical belief which is protected as being worthy of respect in the democratic society. So that was the original judgment of the tribunal. The appeal tribunal set out what the tribunal had said and endorsed its view that my views as set out, anti-Zionist views, were had a clarity and a coherence which made it perfectly clear and plausible that they should be worthy of respect in the democratic society. And in particular, they specified that it was perfectly legitimate to think that an ideology was racist if it introduced people A into a land where people B lived and then expelled most of those people. It was perfectly legitimate to call that racist. And Zionism is racism, and the court has determined that it's perfectly legitimate to say that. They also determined it's perfectly legitimate, given what else we said about Zionism, to refer to Zionism as being colonial and imperialist in nature. And those three things together are a huge victory, because that's, a position that many anti-Zionists 2 or 3 years ago wouldn't even have signed up to. So we've got quite a radical version of anti-Zionism, the most obvious and elementary version, I would say, which is that it's racist, that it's inherently colonial, and it's inherently imperialist. And that's now regarded as being a protected belief under the Equality Act. So that was the most important element of the finding. It endorses those findings from the Employment Appeal Tribunal. And they also, of course, found that I hadn't been motivated by racism against the Jews or prejudice against Judaism or any of those things, as we all, of course, knew. But it specifically endorses that view of the tribunal, which the University of Bristol's counsel really didn't want to have in there. He spent a lot of time trying to say that I was an anti-Semite, even although they had explicitly recognised right at the beginning of the Employment Tribunal that they weren't going to make any kind of case like that. So they were trying to bring back in stuff which had already been dealt with and already been dismissed.
So given what Lord Fairley has said about your expression of anti-Zionism, what do you think the wider implications of the judgment are in terms of being able to protect other people's anti-Zionist expressions, particularly in their workplaces against disciplinary action from their employers?
Well, I mean, it's clearly, first of all, the thing to note is that legally it's a precedent because this has now been determined by two courts, by one court and then a higher court. And it can't be overturned unless it's overturned by a higher court. They might try and do that, but that's the position. It's now a precedent, which means that nobody can be intimidated or sacked or disciplined or removed as a candidate for, on the grounds that they've expressed anti-Zionist views. And that applies across universities, all other workplaces, including councils and businesses and all of those. So it's really important victory for the movement, especially given the massive attack that's been on anti-Zionist views from the state and indeed from the Zionist movement, which we've seen over the last 3 years. And to some extent, the traffic has been mostly one way, the proscription of Palestine Action, the designation of the IRGC, the tons of people who've been disciplined or suspended, doctors and lawyers and accountants, as a result of this Zionist lawfare. But this is a line in the sand, which makes it much more difficult for them to do that in the future and much easier for people to defend themselves.
Professor Miller, earlier we spoke about some of the individuals and organizations involved in the campaign against you. But one we really must speak about in more detail is the Community Security Trust, or CST, which I believe to be Mossad's chief front group in Britain. Who are the CST and what should be done about their penetration of institutions in Britain?
Well, the teaching that I was doing at the time, the lecture I was giving, where I talked about the CST as being part of the Zionist movement, even though they weren't formally a Zionist organization. That got them really, really irate that I was describing them as a Zionist organization. In their first letter of complaint, they said, "We're simply a Jewish charity looking after Jews." The university freaked a bit about that. But of course, I'd been doing research on the CST for many years by that stage, and had submitted evidence in expert evidence in courts on the CST and what it was about, including in the case of the Palestinian politician Raed Sawa, who won his case as a result of, in part at least, of my expert witness statement on the CST. The CST, of course, is an organization which says it's there to combat anti-Semitism and indeed racism and extremism, it says, and its charitable objects. It's a charity. It was set up in 1994. But, of course, its main objective is to attack the left and Muslims and anyone who stand up for the Palestinian cause. In recent years, they've become more and more extreme, such that they now regard spraying Free Palestine on the wall as being an anti-Semitic, potentially anti-Semitic attack. But it's always been a Zionist organization, a hardline Zionist organization, set up by a guy called Gerald Ronson, who famously went to jail as part of the Guinness fraud. So he's a convicted fraudster, as I think he doesn't like to be reminded. And he runs a network of petrol stations up and down the country through his company, Rontec, extremely wealthy. And he set up the Community Security Trust, having set up previously a number of other Zionist, quote, anti-racist groups, including groups back in the 1950s, which had been involved in all sorts of activities which don't reflect well on them. Let's say no more than that. So it's there to effectively police discourse on the question of Palestine, and to disguise that as being a concern about anti-Semitism or racism against the Jews. Of course, there are similar organizations in many other Western countries. The Anti-Defamation League in the US is a very similar organization, also involved in spying on people, which a CST is, and other organizations like that. It's extremely well-funded by Ronson, but also by the government. The government spends millions and millions of pounds on it every year. And there's a kind of grift which they engage in. They say, they do research, they say there's all this anti-Semitism, it's unprecedented, it's worse this year than it was last. And then the next year they say the same thing. And they do that as part of an attempt to get state funding. And then when the state funding comes through, they have to say, well, it's got worse again, we have to have more funding. And so what you find is that the funding attracted to anti-Semitism in this country by the government is in millions and tens of millions of pounds every year.
And they've increased that recently owing to some supposed anti-Semitic incidents
in London.
That's right.
And they increase it, and they increase it every time there's an alleged anti-Semitic incident. But of course, anti-Semitism is not really an actual problem in the country. Almost all of what they describe as anti-Semitism is anti-Zionism. It's nothing to do with hatred of Jews as Jews or any kind of racism. It's a nonsense. It's a farrago dreamt up by the Zionist movement.
Can you just expand on that slightly? Because they often come out with these reports about supposed anti-Semitic incidents. And as you've indicated, most of these incidents relate to anti-Zionism, Palestine, you know, a bit of pro-Palestine graffiti could be classed as an anti-Semitic incident. And this is all part of the supposed never-ending rise of anti-Semitism in Britain.
That's right. Well, that's what they've been. That's what they're there for, and they manage their job very well. They manage to say every year, though, it's just terrible. It's getting worse. The Jews are always hated, and there are new forms of Jew hatred, and they come from the Muslims, and they come from the left. And we didn't really understand this, and now we do. And it's all a way of trying to blur the line between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. So when you criticize genocide, they say, well, that's a blood libel. When you say you should stop killing children, they say, well, that's a blood libel. And these are specific kinds of racist ideas which are held to be directed at Jews.
No one says, one of the most interesting ones is where they keep talking about well poisoning, but you actually have real documented instances in the Zionist entity of them poisoning Palestinian wells.
Well, there are real documented incidences of all the things that we say about the Zionists, of course. We don't make these things up. And even if we did make them up, they wouldn't be racist. So, you know, the whole thing is a nonsense. Whereas we don't ever hear Muslim politicians saying it's a blood libel against the Muslims. It just doesn't exist as an argument. And of course, you know, the main people who are the victims of racism in this country, and this has been the case since at least 9/11, are Muslims. They were the ones who attract the least resources from the state. They are the ones who are the most socioeconomically disadvantaged, and they're the ones who are in receipt of the most racist attacks on the streets, and indeed, of course, structural racism and institutional racism from the police and the security services and all of that. The Jews in this country don't have any institutional discrimination against them by the state. They're not stopped, as they should be, coming back from the colony, having been involved in genocidal activities and war crimes at the very least. None of that happens. They're not securitized. They're not stopped under Schedule 7. You know, I've been stopped under Schedule 7. Many, many thousands of Muslims have been stopped. It's mainly Muslims who are stopped. Jews aren't stopped. And they're not victims of state racism. And they're not actually victims of racism, really, of any sort in the country. They're, by and large, advantaged on an average level. And all of the data to support such a contention comes from government surveys and government data. So there's a kind of inversion of reality which goes on there, where the Jews are given resources for what is effectively the least kind of problem which exists in the country as a result of racism, whereas the Muslims get the least resources.
Mm. I just want to turn now to a deeply important idea that you have advanced, which is that of Pax Judaica. And of course, to understand the campaign against you, it's first necessary to understand Jewish supremacism and also Jewish imperialism as the foremost imperialist power in the world today, its history, its tactics, and how Jewish imperialism acquires and weaponizes proxies. So what is Jewish imperialism, or Pax Judaica, as you've called it?
Well, I think what we've seen in the last 2 years, probably, is a renewed discussion of the question of Jewish supremacy. Now, this really sends many people clutching for their pearls, including some anti-Zionists. And I think it's important to try and tease out what that is and what it means and what it doesn't mean. So, you know, the Zionism is an ideology which, as we determined in the court, which is racist, which believes that Jews have more rights in Palestine than do the indigenous people of Palestine, the Palestinians. And that's a supremacist idea, just as the idea that white Boers who worship with the Dutch Reformed Church had more right in South Africa than did the black people of South Africa. That was a supremacist ideology. You can say it's a Protestant supremacist or a white supremacist ideology. I don't really mind. Just as in Algeria, the idea that the French colonizers there had was that they were superior, that they had more rights. And you can refer to that as white supremacy, French supremacy, or indeed Catholic supremacism. And of course, the other example which we should mention is the north of Ireland, where the statelet of Northern Ireland was set up in 1921, and the borders were drawn specifically so there would always be, in perpetuity, a Protestant majority for the Protestant supremacists who ran the statelet. Protestant supremacists who were in the Protestant church, the various different Protestant churches, and who were quite often attached to an exact parallel of the Zionist movement, the Orange Order, the Orange movement. Now, these are Protestant supremacists. Everybody recognizes that. Nobody throws their hand up in horror when you say words like Protestant supremacists. People don't have any conception that that's a problem. But when you come to Jewish supremacists, they say, well, you're mentioning Jews. That's racist to mention Jews. Well, is it racist to mention Jews? Is it racist, therefore, to mention Protestants? Well, of course it's not. When you mention white supremacists, you don't say all white people are white supremacists. You say white supremacism is an ideology which certain people sign up to. It doesn't mean that all white people must ipso facto necessarily be white supremacists. And that's an empirical question. So that I think is important to start to think properly about Jewish supremacism. And Zionism is a form of Jewish supremacism. And I think one of the other reasons why it's important to think about that is because there are other forms of Jewish supremacism in addition to Zionism, which I think people have really not appreciated very well. And what I mean by that is that most of the Hasidic sects in Judaism were always historically anti-Zionist. But almost all of them were and remain Jewish supremacists. They believe that Jews have more rights, even if they don't believe in a Jewish state, they believe Jews have more rights to settle in Eretz Yisrael, however they might define that, Greater Israel, than do the local inhabitants, whether they're Syrians or Lebanese or Palestinians or Jordanians or whatever it is. So it's important to understand that there can be anti-Zionist Haredi Hasidic or Hasidic groups who are actually Jewish supremacists. And that's the case, I would say, with the largest of those, which is the Satmar. And it's the case also with all other Hasidic groups, which many of which have now made their peace with Zionism, even if they still refuse to send their sons to join the occupation forces. So that's another reason why it's important to talk about Jewish supremacy, because it's not only amongst the Zionists that there's Jewish supremacy. There are other currents of it. So that's what I would say about the question of Jewish supremacy. But then we have to go on to the question, you referred to Jewish imperialism. Well, of course, Zionism was always imperialist and expansionist, eliminationist, wanted to eliminate the natives, tried to do that in the Nakba, are trying to do it again now, and as we see, not just in Gaza, but also in the West Bank and in South Lebanon. So it's always been imperialist. And people used to say, again, that was a conspiracy theory and all that stuff. The stuff about Greater Israel wasn't true. But it's perfectly clear that it was true. It's in all the documents going back that they wanted a Greater Israel. Now, the Greater Israel, of course, that they conceived of then, although there are different definitions, included, part of Egypt, all of Palestine, all of Jordan, all of Lebanon, most of Syria, half of Iraq, part of Turkey. So it's a really large area, half of Saudi Arabia as well, let's remember. But that kind of imperialist expansion, which would see them as the kind of dominant power in West Asia if they had all of that territory, is not the limits of their ambitions. And we see that through their other involvement in attempting to influence and control other elements of West Asia. Most obviously, of course, their key ally in the region outside Eretz Israel is the United Arab Emirates. which they have been in an alliance with for some years, were key to the creation of the Abraham Accords, which is an attempt to generalize and normalize relationships with the Zionist entity throughout West Asia and indeed into North Africa. So that you're already seeing an attempt to influence and control the whole of West Asia and North Africa. And so that's already much greater than the question of Greater Israel. And so that you can see that as an imperialist thing. And of course, there are similar attempts to do similar sorts of things in other places. For example, in Latin America, where what they're attempting to do is to make sure that all countries in Latin America will normalize with the Zionist entity. And of course, they've been really quite successful in that in recent years in demolishing Palestine solidarity amongst Latin American states. So it's not just West Asia, not just North Africa, not just Latin America. It's also they're attempting to invest militarily and in many other ways in influencing Africa, Southeast Asia, Europe, and of course the US. Now, we know, of course, that they've been involved in infiltration of the US for many, many years. The infiltration by the Zionists has been underway for a long, long time, including, let's remember, before the creation of the State of Israel, by Jewish supremacists, most of whom were Zionists. And so I've written about this recently. So you look, for example, at the early activities of the head of counterintelligence of the CIA, James Jesus Angleton, who was responsible in the CIA for liaison with the Shin Bet and the Mossad. That's the internal and external Zionist intelligence services. And that process of infiltrating, penetrating, and colonizing the security establishment of the US has been one of the greatest successes. Became apparent that that was what was happening when they were able to get the Bush administration to illegally invade and occupy Iraq. And of course, most recently, we've got this new legislation, which is about merging, it said, the militaries of the Zionist colony with the US. But of course, it's not really a merger, is it? Because it's about allowing the Zionists access to the US military and the use of the US military. But it doesn't allow a similar process for the US military to access and use Israeli military assets. So that's an indication of that actually the US is effectively becoming or has become an asset, a proxy of the Zionist entity itself. And when you look now then to the question of Europe, you see the same processes at work here. We haven't got the same kind of military penetration that they have in the US. But in France and in Germany, in every European country, there are strong Zionist attempts to subvert and dominate the politics there. In the UK, there is no mainstream political party which is anti-Zionist. Every single party is almost totally controlled by Zionist politics. No one can say anything remotely critical of Zionism. The Green Party is currently involved in an internal debate or a massive faction fight about whether to pass a motion on anti-Zionism to make it an anti-Zionist party later this year. It was already defeated by the Jewish Greens, the Zionist faction within the Greens, at a conference earlier this year. So there's a huge fight on that, but that's the only party which is showing any signs of becoming seriously anti-Zionist. And the same is true in France and Germany with Le Crif in France, etc. So there's been a huge impact of Zionist penetration and infiltration across the whole of West Asia, across Europe, including in Eastern Europe, over in the Caucasus and in Azerbaijan and Armenia, and even across to Southeast Asia with involvement there in supporting Taiwan against the People's Republic of China and other countries as well.
How do you respond to those people who say that you're completely wrong about this because the reason why these Western countries are so Zionist is because they're imperialist, they're racist, they're sympathetic to Zionism? They refer, of course, to the early support given by Britain, the US and other Western countries to the Zionist entity back in the 20th century. They say, well, it's natural for these countries to support the Zionist regime. And they reject this idea that there's been this process of state capture, infiltration, and a recalibration of how imperialism operates. What do you say to those people?
Well, I say, you know, the question is a question of evidence. You can't resolve this just at the level of theory of saying, well, Marxism says, or my own preferred theory says, that this cannot possibly be the case. The tail cannot wag the dog, it simply is impossible. And so the response to that is to say, well, let's look. Why did they take this decision? Who was involved in making sure this decision happened? And when you do that in a long list of specified cases, what you find in the case of the invasion of Iraq, everybody knows this was an invasion on behalf of Israel, which was put in place not by the Zionist regime, but by the Zionist regime's assets inside the security establishment of the US, the neoconservatives. These are people who are Americans, right? And that's the thing. People say, well, the US took these decisions. It's in the US interest to do so. And you say, well, let's look at the way in which these decisions were made. Who was pushing for them? Was it WASPs? Was it white Anglo-Saxon Protestants? Was it US officials who didn't have any particular relationship with Zionism? And they decided that the Zionist interest was in the best interest of America? Well, actually, no, that's not the case.
Well, when it comes to neoconservatism, people might mention Dick Cheney.
They might mention Dick Cheney. Of course, there are one or two non-Jews in the neoconservative movement, a couple of Catholics. And like in both Trump 1 and Trump 2, you have a couple of Christian Zionists, or people who are more or less Christian Zionists, Hegseth or Rubio, for example. But the overwhelming majority of these people are Jewish Zionists, believing Jewish Zionists. And Christian Zionism is, in terms of firepower in policy circles, not in terms of numbers necessarily, but in firepower in policy circles, is in the driving seat. It's perfectly plain that that's the case. And if it was the case that the CIA or the MI6 or MI5 had decided that it was the British interest to pursue these policies, well, we would be able to follow that in policy processes and think tanks and the funding. But none of that is the case. And actually, what you find is that there are circumstances in which there are elements in the security state of Western states who are critical of some aspects of Zionism. So, for example, many of the protest movements in the Zionist colony, the liberal Zionist protest movements, have actually been funded by the National Endowment for Democracy, by USAID, effectively by the CIA. So you can see that there are elements of the security apparatus, even after this kind of what I would regard as a Zionist takeover, which are still a bit uncomfortable with that. And they're still engaged in those kinds of activities. There are subversion activities which they carry out in other places. But that's not the dominant fraction of the Anglo security apparatus. So the reason why I put this in terms of Pax Judaica, people say, well, you shouldn't use the word Jews. Well, I say, you know, refer back to the earlier question. What's wrong with using the word Jews? These people are Jews. The ones in charge of the Orange Order are Protestants. You can't be a Catholic and join the Orange Order. What's wrong with describing what is actually the case? Does it mean that if you start to talk about Protestants, that you will become an anti-Protestant racist? And it's so laughable. When you even say those words, it's completely laughable. Now, you know, I come from a Protestant background, a white Scottish Protestant background. Nobody's ever said to me that I'm a self-hating Protestant. You know, I wouldn't mind if they did, but it's just ridiculous. So, you know, this is a particular kind of ideology which is burgeoned within Judaism. It's not all of Judaism. It's not all of the Jews, of course, just like I'm not a Protestant supremacist. But it is an important current within Judaism, and it has a certain amount of power. It's pursued that power through the Zionist movement and through other associated movements, including through the expansionism and the eliminationism of Zionism. Everybody can see that the last 3 years. Everybody sees that. More and more people see it. So there's nothing wrong with seeing this as being a Jewish project. They see it as a Jewish project. They call it the Jewish state. They see it as a Jewish expansionist project. Benjamin Netanyahu has recently been referring specifically to the role of Israel as a regional, perhaps a global superpower. He's actually said those words. And people will say, well, you don't believe anything he says, or he doesn't mean it. Well, no, he does mean it. He does mean it. And that's the thing which I think people have got to understand. They've got to wake up and smell the coffee, that when they say that they're going to do these things, they actually mean to do them. They might be stopped, but they actually mean to do them. And we should, pay attention to what they say and believe what they say about their activities and their motives. Although, of course, we do remember that Zionists lie a great deal. And you've got to understand that the difference between the two. So Pax Judaica, I think, is a way of saying that if they are not defeated, if they are not stopped, they are attempting to become a new empire. Now, this won't be like old empires. We already know the way in which empires have evolved. We already know that Pax Britannica or Pax Americana, the idea of occupying everywhere to make them colonies, either with settler colonies or administrative colonies like India, those days are gone. The process of decolonization, which we went through in the world in the 50s and 60s and 70s, it is not going to be reversed. And there are new ways in which colonization occurred as a result. Neocolonialism, it was referred to, and the exploitation by transnational capital, by the international financial apparatus, the IMF and the World Bank, etc. We understand that that's the way in which imperialism dominates the developing world or the global south. And so it's not going to be like Pax Britannica. It's not going to be just like Pax Americana. It's not going to be dominated by an Israeli navy. There's going to be no such thing. Although, of course, they do have the useful proxy of the US Naval Service to help them out with their attack on Iran, for example. So the way in which it's been operating has been through, as we mentioned, these normalization processes, but also through a whole series of other processes which have been kind of under the radar for many people. And one of the key ones is this mythology that they've encouraged about Israel being a startup nation. And there are all these tech companies, and they're leading in tech and in AI. And again, Netanyahu talks about this. The aim is to make them a leading nation in tech and in AI. Now, what that of course involves is large numbers of people who have gone through Unit 8200, which is the signals intelligence unit of the Zionist entity, who set up tech startups and then expand across the world into sometimes quite large companies. And the purpose of this is not just to make money for the Zionist entity, which of course it does, but also to find ways of controlling societies in which they operate. And let me specifically say what that means. So organizations like Celebrite or the NSO Group or Black Cube or Black Core or many others, there are hundreds of these companies. They sell surveillance equipment, they sell drones, they sell mechanisms for oppression to repressive regimes everywhere. But they also, and this is the innovative bit, I guess you could say, they also have mechanisms whereby they can control this technology even when it's sold to a client. So when the FBI bought the NSO Group's Pegasus software, it was possible for someone in Tel Aviv, in the NSO Group, to look at who the FBI was surveilling. Now that's an extraordinary power. And that's the case with quite a number of these surveillance organizations, whether they're running the CCTV in Glasgow, or whether they're in Angola, or whether they're in Saudi Arabia. This process is partly about money, yes, partly about surveillance, but partly it's about the extension of Zionist power through a set of commercial relationships, which I think people have not really understood. And that's extremely important. More recently, we've seen it not just to to do with the question of surveillance, but also the question of the manipulation of elections. So both Black Core and Black Cube are firms which have been involved directly in such activities. They were involved in subverting the Slovenian election, such that the new government in Slovenia is now anti-Palestinian, whereas before it was pro. There's a French government investigative body which has recently come out and said that one of these firms has been involved in manipulating elections in France, in Africa, in Scotland, and in many other places. This is an ongoing process, and one of the key ways in which Pax Judaica will be exported. And there's a second thing. There are many parts to this, but there's a second thing which it's worth mentioning. So we saw recently the example of Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump attempting to buy an island in Albania, and also the coast alongside inland of the island, to set up some kind of luxury resort. And this is the island was, of course, used to be a military base, submarine base, Soviet military base, with enough nuclear shelters for 3,000 troops. And those tunnels, etc., are all still there. So, of course, people were suspicious. There have been big demonstrations in Albania about this, about what the purpose of this was, and whether it was just whether it was a new Epstein Island or whether it was going to be used as a military base for the Zionists. And of course, it was in a very strategic place, overseeing the straits which come down the side of Italy, from the Adriatic into the Mediterranean. Now, that is an interesting example. But it's not an isolated example. It's part of a wider strategy. And there's actually, as it happens, similar activities happening in the heel of the boot of Italy, right across the water from Albania. Similar kinds of settlement practices. There's similar activities happening in Cyprus, in Greece, in Thailand, in Argentina, in many other countries where there is an influx of Israelis. There are all sorts of activities which go on, which are described by the authorities as crimes. There are settlement activities. There's the buying up of abandoned villages and the creation of effectively Israeli settlements in Greece, for example, or in Cyprus. And all of that is an indication that there's a new way in which the Zionists are trying to spread out their power across the world. Of course, part of it's to do with the fact that many Zionists are leaving the colony because they realize that its days may be numbered, and because of the genocide there. But this is an indication that it's not just a question of normalization. It's not just a question of commercial and surveillance activities. It's also a question of actual settlement, much much more widely than in Greater Israel or West Asia.
What you've outlined there is so important, especially your explanation about the recalibration of how imperialism operates. Just like Pax Americana didn't operate like Pax Britannica, with colonialism replaced with neocolonialism, Pax Judaica doesn't operate like Pax Americana. The Jewish state has adapted to the landscape of the world as it is today, and the manifestation of their imperial power also reflects their size, which is why they tend to operate in a parasitic way, you know, using the US host body and proxies to project power and influence. And as you said, this can all be traced and examined with material evidence. But just circling back to your legal case, what lessons should Muslims, the left and the right, take from your victory?
Well, I think the most obvious lesson is that you don't give in. That when you were attacked by the Zionists, the wrong thing to do is to apologize, to go quiet, to wonder if you've maybe offended or upset someone. The wrong thing to do is to back down, just to step back. The right thing to do is to step forward and to be clear that Zionism is racism, that Zionism is colonialist and imperialist, and that it needs to be defeated and dismantled, the whole of Zionism, not just the occupation, not just this or that part of Zionism, but all of Zionism needs to be dismantled and defeated. And the price that you pay for doing that, of course, can be significant. You know, I was put out of a job. I've not had a penny from the University of Bristol since then. And that's been personally difficult. But the price is worth paying because, you know, in the end, what we are doing and what we are saying is correct. The Zionism's racism is a matter of fact. And if we bend the knee, if we step back in front of the Zionists, well, then they will keep doing it to us again, to everyone else in the future. You can't really find a way. There's no way to coexist with Zionism. Zionism must be defeated. And people in the movement need to understand that it doesn't help to apologize. It doesn't help to go quiet. You've got to stand up and fight, and everyone has to support each other. And that's one of the key problems on the left, it seems to me, and indeed even in the Muslim community, is the reluctance somehow and sometimes to support those of us who are outspoken. They say, oh, well, these things that people have been saying, they're a bit irresponsible, or they're a bit out there, or I'm not really sure I could go along with that. But actually, look, in the end, we have one enemy, and that is Zionism. And if we don't all pull together to fight them, they will win. And that will not be pleasant for anyone, regardless of how polite you are, how nice you are, and how much you're willing to apologize. That won't be enough. And so the only answer is that the Zionists must be fought and they must be defeated.
Well, Professor Miller, I know that you have endured a lot of sacrifice, perhaps more than most people realize, because of your research and teaching and speaking the truth, essentially. And you've been persecuted for that. You've been treated appallingly. And I find it inspiring and extraordinary, and I hope that others do too, that after all that, you say that the sacrifice is worth it. And your case has clearly proven that, despite the long war that it's been. In the end, you've been victorious multiple times, and your victory has helped countless other people, not just through the inspiration that it gives, but also concretely under equality law. And that's no small thing, and I really respect and admire you for doing that. We should all learn from you. And on that note, we'll have to draw this conversation to an end. Professor Miller, congratulations to you again, and thank you for appearing on the show today.
Thank you.
And thank you very much to all of our listeners and viewers. If you found this content beneficial, please make sure to like this video and to subscribe to the channel if you haven't already done so. Help us to overcome the algorithmic limitations that we're facing, and we'll see you on the next one.